they said, wasn't worth it when the drought burned your crops. Man, what the sun didn't burn, the grasshoppers devoured. They were already 2 payments behind with the bank, so Lockwood was able to buy the place from them for a song. Then off the Hodges family went, in a rust-eaten green truck with its bed full of sticks for furniture. Lockwood watched as they disappeared down the road in a cloud of dust, a clatter of gears grinding within the ancient vehicle. Then he turned to his farm and started to work it. He was from somewhere up in New England, people in Temperance said after he'd been around town a while, though none had heard this come out of Lockwood's mouth, and he didn't sound any different from them. He'd been the child of a minister, some said. Where he got his money, no one knew. But he arrived with enough to buy the Hodges farm when the Depression had grown so terrible that no one had cash any longer, not even hidden under their mattresses. There were whispers that he must have robbed his father's church before leaving. There were whispers of an argument between the father and son that had sent him packing. And though no one could trace the whispers back to a credible source, they lingered, as whispers do, as the voice of the living death tree lingered in my own ears, telling me this story. Each morning Lockwood rose before the sun did, and each night he returned to the house after the sun dipped below the horizon. He sowed fields and cut hay on days when the sun was strong and the wind dry, and when he wasn't tilling he was working to get his first corn in, to pick through his orchard, taking bites from the occasional apple as he climbed through the branches. He repaired the falling down barn, painted the paint-flaked white house a goldenrod color, and after his first harvest, he'd made enough money to acquire a few necessities, 2 cowls, a bull, and a wife. He had one of the town girls in mind, a young woman he saw on her way to church each Sunday. Her name was Pluma Winchell, but everyone in Temperance called her Plumy. Her name reminded him of feathers, of smoke, of soft rose petals, all things that tickled. And indeed, he was tickled each time he saw her walk through the town green with her mother, coming or going to church or the butcher. Her mother would slap Plumy's arm whenever she caught her cutting looks his way. "What are you looking at, girl?" she'd say. But that only made Plumy smile even harder. He took Pluma Winchell for a wife the following spring, after the winter melted and the orchard blossomed. And when Lockwood brought her home, she exclaimed at the beauty of the apple blossoms that fell around her, dusting her shoulders. "Like snow," she said. Only they held the warmth of the sun and the fragrance of early summer. In their second year together, Lockwood became a father to a son, John Jr., and soon after, he purchased several neighboring farms when the banks foreclosed on their previous owners. The hands he hired to help as his own farm grew were sometimes the men who had owned the pieces of land he'd acquired. Most were immigrants with made-up first names like Mike or Charlie, and real last names like Drobnieski or Kubi, who had dreamed of owning something in America. Now they scrabbled to survive and worked for what Lockwood offered, and with their help his harvests grew even larger. By his third year, the farm ran like clockwork. Hay twice in the summer, apples and corn in the fall. He switched one field over to oats, and Plumy started a vegetable garden between the creek and the house, putting up jars of tomatoes and carrots and green beans in the cold stone cellar. The bull Lockwood bought the year before had got the 2 cows with calf, so his livestock doubled. Things were going well, even if some of the hands were set to gather in one of the taverns near Mosquito Lake on weekends and complained that Lockwood had stolen their property. A land baron, some called him. And from my place in the shadows of their story, I winced, trying to recall where I'd heard those words. They rattled around in the back of my memory like forgotten coins in a packet. And when I picked them up to examine them, I remembered being a child at some school function for my brother Toby. I was no more than 8 or 9, and the father of one of Toby's classmates was sticking a finger in my dad's face, arguing about something to do with the baseball game we'd been watching. I can't remember what sent them into an argument, but at some point during their fight, the man told my dad he wasn't better than anyone else in Temperance just because he'd come from a family of land barons. "What did he mean?" I'd ask my dad as we walked away from the field not long after, making our way back to the Blue Bomb. "Don't worry about it, Aiden," my dad had said, putting his big hand on my shoulder. "He doesn't know what he's talking about." When I thought about it now, it didn't make sense. My dad and Grandma Benny had had to sell off most of the farm and parcels over the years, just to get by after my granddad put a gun to his head and left my grandma to take care of a farm and a son on her own. We'd lost all of the land my great-grandfather, the real land baron, had purchased. Lockwood. Great-grandfather Lockwood. Now he stood on the railroad tie bridge he'd laid across Sugar Creek when he first arrived, and watched as the sun sank below the silhouettes of the trees at the back of his property.
"There has to be something else," he thought, as he crossed the bridge to wander the fields at twilight.
I could hear the faint voice of his father in the recesses of Lockwood's memory, the minister he'd stolen from to come here, to buy this property.
The gloaming, Lockwood's father had called the hour when the boundary between worlds was thin and the fae folk could be seen on the horizon.
Behind his father's back, Lockwood had laughed at those stories, had laughed at how they'd come from his father's mouth. Imagine a minister believing in such things. But looking back, Lockwood didn't hold it against his superstitious father either. With a distance between them now, he was able to even find it a little charming. To think he had come from such a family. To think how he had somehow escaped them to make a better life than the one he'd been given. He failed to remember that he'd stolen from his family in order to make this better life.
One evening in late summer, he drifted through the cornfields, their stalks taller than his head, their leaves brushing his face and shoulders.
They were whispering of their pleasure in the soil, but Lockwood couldn't understand their vegetable language. And when they finally fell away from him, he found himself at the back of his property, at the edge of the woods, where he put the cows to pasture. The cows and their calves weren't there at this hour. They were back in the barn, their eyelids lowered. But something at first glance made him think one of them must have remained behind. It stood in the shadows of the oaks and hickories, snorting at him. Lockwood was about to clap his hands and holler for the cow to move up the lane to the barn, but before his hands could meet one another, he froze, gasping at the creature that stepped out of the shadows. It was no cow after all. There, where the pasture met the woods, stood a white stag with antlers that branched out and farther out into a twisted ivory candelabra. The stag that had let me ride it home from another place in time. The stag that had let me ride it back to my own story. The stag's eyes were round and black, its fur silver-white, and the tips of its antlers glowed in the purple evening shadows. Lockwood blinked as he dimly recalled a story his father had told him, a story in which this creature existed, a story Lockwood had never believed.
"There is more than this," the stag told him.
Just that, nothing else. It was as if the creature had emerged from the woods to deliver this one message as a warning. And for one long moment, as Lockwood stood there, open-mouthed and staring, he thought he might be dreaming. Then the stag lifted its tail and kicked away, back into the woods, gone, as if it had never existed. The vision began to shimmer then, and darkness filled my eyes like black water.
"Do you remember this story?"
the voice asked me. I shook my head in the dark and said no, I didn't. I'd never seen any of this, not that I could remember.
"I showed it to you once," she said. "I told you this story when you were still a boy."
"When?" I asked.
"When you were 13," the voice told me. "When you were awakening to the invisible world around you."
"I don't remember any of this," I said.
"Then I will show you once again," the voice said. "I will show you what should not be forgotten."
The dark retreated. Light filled my eyes again. And in the center of that light, I saw a young boy. A dark-haired boy with green eyes and a streak of dirt smeared across his sweaty forehead.
"A boy,"
the tree whispered.
who was slowly and secretly becoming a criminal.
The criminal's name was Dobry Jablonski. 12 years old, he lived with his mother on the edge of Temperance in a one-room shack his father had built shortly before dying. For years after emigrating from Poland, his family had lived in a mining town over the border in Pennsylvania, but they'd left a year earlier to finally start a farm of their own in Ohio, to start the life they'd dreamed of making.
Lies, Dobry Jablonski thought. This country is full of them.
He hadn't been able to convince his father of this, even after they'd lost their land, or his mother, even after she began to take in other people's laundry, and all because they'd chosen to sail across the Atlantic and dream their lives into something better. But over time, Dobry had come to notice how the dream of a better life didn't happen for most people, no matter how hard they worked, perhaps especially for those who worked the hardest. He would have complained to his mother about this, as he'd complained to his father, if only she hadn't lost her husband so recently. He didn't want to deplete what hope she might have left for their future. Hope could keep people going, he knew that, and he wanted his mother to keep going, despite how he felt. Dobry was the man of the house now. His father had told him this while coughing up blood into a dirty handkerchief on his deathbed. That was months earlier, when the farm still belonged to them. Now Dobry worked for the man who had bought his father's farm when they could no longer make payments. Now he worked for the man who paid the wages of a slave.
There is no difference between this country and where we come from, Dobry thought as he stashed a basket full of apples at the edge of the orchard.
He would walk past it later, after work, and take them home.
If this man wants to pay me a slave's wages, I will do what I must to compensate.
Tall wooden ladders leaned into the green canopies of the orchard, and the hands climbed up and down the rungs in dirty trousers held up by suspenders. Each picker held a sack in front of his stomach, with a rope strapping the sack around his neck. Arms outstretched, they reached into the light of the golden evening, past the thick leaves of late summer, to pluck the fat apples from their stems. Others wandered between the trees to deposit the apples in barrels Lockwood had placed near the corn crib. But Dobry had other plans. After leaving his stolen apples at the far edge of the orchard, he ran back to continue picking. From the bedroom window on the second floor of the house, Plumy watched the boy at the edge of the orchard, stealing apples from her husband. She held the curtains apart only a few inches. Her breath was held at that moment, but the sheer blind swayed before her. It was I, a ghost standing next to her, who disturbed the curtains. The dark-haired boy, with green eyes and skin as pale as chalk, was stealing. Plumy had been watching him hurry away in the late afternoons with a sack full of apples for weeks now. She hadn't told her husband because the boy looked sick, and the apples would do him good, she figured. And anyway, her husband didn't pay the boy enough but to buy a scrap of meat at the end of the week and minor provisions like salt and flour, perhaps a sweet to suck on for an hour. Her own children didn't want for anything. Plumy saw this as a fragile condition worth maintaining, but her heart still skipped a beat whenever she saw Dobry Jablonski scurrying away for the sake of a few apples. There he was now, returning, sack empty, to climb into the trees, to pull down the fat apples for the Lockwoods. When Plumy turned to go downstairs, I followed her, taking the steps I took every day of my life down into the kitchen. Plumy needed to feed her daughter. Ethel would be hungry at this hour. The girl was a much easier baby than John Jr. had been. Initially, Plumy had thought there would be some kind of strange competition with a girl for her husband's attention. This was something Plumy's own mother had told her to watch out for. But Ethel could not have cared less about her father. He was so rarely around. Off hunting, planting, cutting, raking, slopping manure into the spreader. And there he was now. Plumy saw him to the kitchen window while Ethel sucked at her breast. He was coming up the lane from the woods. Beside him, sunlight glinted on the rippled surface of Sugar Creek. When Ethel finished, Plumie put her in the crib and went out to meet her husband. But when she looked through the gate of the barn, where she'd assumed he was headed, he wasn't there. And he wasn't in the lane where she'd seen him through the kitchen window a few minutes earlier. She turned toward the orchard then, and found him trudging across the railroad tie bridge. She had to raise her hand to block the sun, though, and by the time she got the light out of her eyes, he had disappeared into the red-globed trees, where the hands could be seen stripping the apples away from their limbs. A moment later, five crows fluttered out of the trees like an omen and cut through the blue air to land on the other side of the hayfield, looking back at the orchard and nodding together, as if they knew something bad was about to happen. And only seconds later, Lockwood emerged from the orchard holding Dobridge Oblonsky by the shirt collar, slapping the back of the boy's head to make him move faster. The boy fell several times on the journey, went down on his hands and knees in the dirt and the ruts that led toward the barn. But Lockwood pulled him up, again and again, until they were in Plumie's garden, near her rhubarb. As they passed her, the boy managed to give Plumie a pleading look, like a nervous cow on its way up to the chute to be slaughtered, and Plumie said, "John? John, what's the matter here? What's happened?" Her husband didn't answer. He only moved toward the barn like a slow black cloud, full of thunder. Once in the barn, he tied the Jablonski boy's hands to a post with binder twine that scratched at the boy's wrists and bit into his skin even as Lockwood knotted it tighter. Plumie came to watch them from the front gate, her hand at her heart, which fluttered like the crows had. Something terrible was about to happen. "John," she said, trying again to reach him, to reason with him. "What are you doing? This is a child. Have you forgotten?"
"You'll be sleeping with the cows tonight," Lockwood told the boy, ignoring his wife's pleas. "And tomorrow you'll go to Warren to speak with the sheriff. What do you think about that, little thief?"
When Dobridge Oblonsky didn't answer, Lockwood spat at the boy's feet. He unlatched the gate, still ignoring Plumie, and went back to the orchard full of anger and righteousness, to deliver a lecture on the villainy of thievery, to teach the Slavs and the Poles and whoever else worked on his farm a lesson. Plumie whispered into the air, as if God might hear her. "Oh, please, oh, please, oh, please," she whispered. And each plea flew away like a crow, silent, sleek, and mysterious. Word spread quickly that night, from household to household. Families who rarely spoke across their respective divisions talked of what had happened in the Lockwood orchard. Fathers and mothers warned their children not to steal, not here, not if they knew what was best for them. They scolded children who didn't even work for Lockwood. They scolded children who didn't work anywhere at all. Dobridge Oblonsky would be made into an example, and they knew this. This was exactly Lockwood's intention, to have everyone in Temperance distribute this warning for him, as he'd assumed they would. Lockwood wandered around the house that night, oiling his rifle, occasionally peering out the window at the barn, where the Jablonski boy sat in manure, his legs splayed in front of him, his hands tied around a pole at his back. People had been tried for less, had gone to jail for less than stealing apples. Lockwood knew this, and he didn't care that he might seal the boy into a dark fate by taking him to see the sheriff in Warren the next morning. At 10 o'clock, Lockwood joined his wife in bed, where he fell asleep as if nothing of great importance weighed on his shoulders, as if any other ordinary day had come to its inevitable end. Later, I came to stand over them, the sleeping figures of my great-grandparents, and watch their moth-like breath hover over their parted mouths, watch the dip and rise of their stomachs as they inhaled and exhaled in unison. Lockwood's dreams were busy that night. I watched them pass through his mind as his body slept. He dreamed of the white stag he'd seen at the back of his property. He dreamed of the stag lowering its head to take a long drink from Sugar Creek. When the stag had finally quenched its thirst, it raised its head and turned to look at him. "There is more than this," it told Lockwood. And then Lockwood woke, sitting up in bed before me, shivering in a cold sweat. Breakfast first, he thought, splashing his face with water in the washroom. Then he'd put the boy in his truck and drive over to Warren. He'd have one of the hands manage the farm for the day. He'd give instructions to the letter, and the work would get done as if he'd overseen it himself, especially with the Jablonski boy's fate weighing on the pickers. Plumy had breakfast ready by the time he got downstairs. She fed him eggs and bacon and toast and coffee. He drank the coffee black and bitter, the steam curling into his flaring nostrils. After finishing, he rubbed bits of egg out of his mustache and stood to leave. Outside, while he sat on the porch to pull his boots on, he looked up to find a woman walking down the dusty road. She wore a scarf over her head. A babushka, the Slav woman called them. Her skirts were nearly in rags. He could see that even from this distance. Her arms were folded under her breasts, as if she was sick or frightened. But if she was frightened, it did not stop her. She came toward him without hesitating, barefoot, turning off the road into his dirt drive, and walking up the front yard to meet him. Lockwood stood on the porch looking down at her.
"Morning, ma'am," he said. "What can I do for you?"
The corners of the woman's mouth were turned down, and her eyes were glassy. Lockwood figured this must be the boy's mother. She had the same pale skin and green eyes. And what she did next nearly shocked him. It was something he'd never seen before. The woman got down on her knees before him, and in a thickly accented voice, begged for the life of her son.
"Get up," Lockwood said, trying to pull her from the ground. "Get up, woman."
But she would not rise.
"It costs me nothing to beg," she told him. "I already lost everything years ago. In Poland, my family was better. My father was a healer. We were respected, you see. Here we are nothing. Things can change for the worse, not just better. I understand this now. If you did not know this already, I will tell you. My son is all I have in this world. His father is dead. If I do not have my son, I die also. Please, I beg you. I ask only for you to give me my son, and he will repay twice what he took from you."
Lockwood did not immediately answer. This woman, Ava Jablonski, if he remembered her name correctly, was something else. He was reminded of a different world, of a different time, when peasants knelt to beg for their lives or for the life of another. He thought of some of the tales his father had told him as a child. He thought of how the lords in those old tales displayed their lordliness by pardoning or by setting a task before a beggar to earn what they wanted. And wasn't he a kind of lord now? He thought. Wouldn't it be right to make a pact with this woman who asked for something without shame?
"I'll make you a deal," he told Ava Jablonski.
The woman narrowed her eyes but held his stare. Lockwood turned to face the orchard, pointing toward it.
"If you can pick that orchard clean by the time the sun sets, I'll give you back your boy."
Ava Jablonski turned to face the orchard, assessing the task set before her. She blinked twice, nodded wordlessly, then stood again, gathering her skirts around her to trudge toward the trees. Lockwood did not mention that nearly a quarter of the apples had been picked yesterday, that it had taken an entire day of five hands working together to clear just that one corner of the orchard. He had made the pact, and now he would see, as any lord would, if she kept her end of the bargain. All that morning, Ava Jablonski climbed the orchard ladders deep into the branches of the trees, picking apples. The sun rose higher, grew hotter, and as the farm's hands arrived, Lockwood informed them that there would be no work for them that day. They crossed the bridge over Sugar Creek anyway, and called up into the trees to Ava, asking her what had happened. Ava did not linger with them. She simply said,
"I picked these apples. Dolbury comes home,"
and continued picking. The others looked at each other, wide-eyed, and started to climb the ladders to help. No, Lockwood said from behind the ring they'd formed around the tree Ava inhabited. She must do this alone. Though they couldn't help Ava Jablonski pick the orchard, the hands rallied around her, carrying cups of water up the ladder to her occasionally. Once, two pieces of crusty bread. She stuffed the bread in her mouth and guzzled the water while still picking. Water sluiced down her chin, washing away trails of grime. Good work, Ava! Someone shouted up to her. Someone else said, Keep going! But Ava didn't acknowledge their cries. She continued picking, placing the apples in the bag around her neck, carrying them to the barrels by the corn crib with clockwork precision. Sometime in the early afternoon, Lockwood gave permission for the boy to be brought to the orchard, bound, to watch his mother work for him. She was not aware of his presence as he watched her struggle, sometimes becoming entangled in the branches, sometimes nearly falling in order to save him. He cried silently, the tears washing down his dirty face, as his mother heaved herself from tree to tree. She was not healthy, this much he knew. She had the same sickness that had killed his father. He could tell by the way she lumbered with the sacks of apples, coughing, wheezing harder as each hour passed, that she would soon not be able to pick any longer. By 5 o'clock that evening, Ava Jablonski had cleared more than half the orchard. This in itself was a feat no one had thought possible. She had a quarter of the trees left to pick before the sunset. She had 2 hours left, three at most, and many men began to beg Lockwood to accept what she had done so far as payment for her son's transgression. Lockwood sat on the edge of the corn crib, chewing the stem of a daisy, and shook his head. "We've made a pact," he told Ava's supporters. "It would only be an offense to her if I change the rules now." By 7 o'clock that evening, Ava Jablonski had picked nearly all of the apples in the orchard. The barrels were full to overflowing. The woman was hunched over in a terrible way. Sweat beaded and fell down her brow. Her mouth hung open. Her tongue lolled like the clapper in a bell. "Only a few more, Ava," her supporters said from below. "Keep going! Only a few more!" She fell into a pile of rags and skin and bones at 7:30, when the light was amber, glazing over the orchard like honey, and shadows had begun to spread. No one moved to pick her up. They waited, breaths held, hands at their mouths. And after a moment, the woman looked around, blinking, narrowing her eyes as if she'd gone blind, then somehow pulled herself up and went on to the last tree. "She's going to do it!" a woman shouted, smiling from within her babushka. Another mother, thought Lockwood. He wandered beneath the last of the apple trees, shaking his head at the marvel that was occurring. "The fierceness or stupidity of mothers," he thought. Which of these traits did Ava Jablonski exhibit? He himself was unsure whether he'd do what Dobry's mother was doing if it were his own child who was endangered. Ava Jablonski picked through the apples in that last tree until the sun was nothing more than a red sliver on the horizon, lowering. She picked, then bagged the apple, picked, then bagged the next, heaving and sobbing, murmuring a nonsensical prayer. By the stunned and confused faces of her friends, it seemed not even those who spoke her language could understand what she was saying. And just as the sun lowered to the other side of the world, Ava Jablonski plucked the last apple from the last tree in the orchard. She held the fruit in her hand, held her arm high in the air, and a bellow of exhausted strength flew out of her. People began to cry out. "She has done it!" they shouted. "She has done it!" And even Lockwood himself applauded the woman's tenacity, clapping his hands together slowly, shaking his head in admiration. Everyone waited for Ava Jablonski to climb down and embrace her son. But slowly the arm holding the apple sank. Then the woman's legs gave way beneath her, and she fell several feet before she was stopped halfway to the ground, caught in a tangle of branches. Her body hung in the tree for several moments before those below realized she was not moving. And finally a woman shouted,
Get her out, quickly! Someone help her down from there!
Someone untied the woman's son, and Dobry ran to the tree. His wrists red and raw from the twine that had held him. He climbed up to her and put his face next to hers, but could not feel her breathing, and could not hear the pulse of her blood.
Mama,
he whispered.
Mama, get up!
But Eva Jablonski remained still. Two big men climbed up to fetch the woman's body. They pulled her down and laid her out on the ground beneath the tree, where everyone crowded to look at her for a long moment. Then, after they understood that Eva was dead, they picked her up and carried her away, back to her ramshackle one-room house at the edge of Temperance. Before they left, Dobry Jablonski turned back to Lockwood and stared hard, his green eyes flashing.
"You killed my mother," he said,
and his voice had turned rough, as if he had become a man in an instant. His voice scraped with anger, anger that was large and growing larger by the second, anger that was too large for a small boy to contain. Lockwood shook his head and said,
"We made a pact, your mother and I. You should be proud of her. She kept her side. She has paid for your freedom."
But Dobry Jablonski continued to stare at Lockwood, who seemed unnerved by the boy standing in front of him, refusing to leave with the others. He was rattled enough to take from his pants pocket a silver watch and stretched across the space between them, placing it in the boy's hand.
"Take this," he told Dobry Jablonski. "May it be a help to you in your future."
Dobry's eyes never left Lockwood's. They held his gaze throughout the entire transaction. And then, as Lockwood slowly but surely backed away from the boy, Dobry lifted one finger, pointing it at the man like a wand, and with an air of finality in his hate-steadied voice, he said,
"You will grow old before your time. You will die in a place where no man will be with you. Your land will be taken from you, and your sons and their sons and their sons will wither until your name has no meaning."
There was magic in those words. It nearly shimmered in the space between Dobry's finger and Lockwood, like heat rising from a coal-patched road in summer. The silver pocket watch in Dobry's other hand gleamed, as if possessed by a spark of magic. Lockwood cocked his head to the side, then spat on the ground between them. The boy said no more. Eventually he turned to leave, and followed the caravan that carried his dead mother down the back roads, back to their home. Lockwood did not give the boy's words too much attention. But later that night he awoke, soaked in his own sweat, from a dream of the boy and his green eyes staring at him as he recited those same words.
"Old before your time. You will die alone. Your sons will wither."
And in the dream, the boy's mother, Eva, rose from where she lay tangled in the branches of the apple tree, to pluck the words out of the air and tuck them deep inside a fold of her ragged skirts for safekeeping. The sound of thunder cracked the sky open like a pocket watch, and Lockwood jumped from his bed to see lightning illuminate his bedroom window. He crossed the room, feet cold on the bare floor, to pull back the curtains and watch the coming storm. Lightning flashed again, creating momentary cracks in the sky, and each time a bolt flashed, the barn and the orchard and the creek were briefly lit up below. Lockwood thought he should check on the cows, but just as he was about to go downstairs, he saw someone outside in the storm. A person. A person down in the orchard. The silhouette of a person standing beneath the swaying limbs of the apple trees. Lightning flashed once more, and there she was, a woman standing beneath the tree Eva Jablonski had died in. When the lightning disappeared, the landscape winked out of existence, leaving Lockwood in the dark of his room, shaking his head. Another flash appeared moments later, but this time the bolt cut straight through the heart of the tree, setting the leaves on fire while smoke poured from the hole the lightning had cut through the trunk. Lockwood ran downstairs and out of the house, barefoot, the rain soaking him, and crossed the railroad tie bridge over Sugar Creek into the orchard. The woman he'd seen there, had she been hit by the lightning? When he reached the tree, though, he found no one. Licks of fire still crackled across the limbs while the trunk continued to smoke in the night. The Jablonski woman. This had something to do with her. Lockwood was sure of it. But he shook his head after entertaining that thought. Was he turning into his foolish father now? Somehow believing what the Jablonski boy had said? Believing that curses had power? Believing that he would die alone in the middle of nowhere? Believing that the family he was making would die in the soil he'd planted them in? The people of Temperance would come to call this plot of land Sorrow Acre. In time, though, they'd forget the reasons behind that name, and they would forget the woman who died as she toiled for her son's life. They would pack up all of their regrets and blissfully forget all that they could forget, protecting themselves from the sorrow that filled the soil and the trees in this place like a poison. The pact Lockwood had made with Ava Jablonski had guaranteed this, Lockwood realized. Ava had kept her end of the bargain. And one day he would keep his. On the horizon, a creature of mist and shadow moved along the tree line, its eyes dark and glassy, its antlers flickering. Lockwood couldn't see it this time, but he sensed its nearness, as he sensed my own presence in the nearby shadows, the same presence he'd feel when I was with him several years later as we fell through a night sky in Europe. He was already making plans. How to find the creature. How to kill it. He didn't know why, but he sensed the ill will the creature held for him. A war was about to begin in Europe. Rumbles and rumors of it had already begun. He would go there when they called for him to fight. He would go there even if they didn't call for him. And several years later, he would meet the creature again, in its own woods this time, on the other side of the Atlantic. He would find it once more, after I'd flung myself out of the belly of an airplane with him. And after he found the stag again, he'd take the first step along the path each of his sons and grandsons would eventually take after him, until they had all withered and the name Lockwood no longer held any meaning. "Do you understand now?" the voice asked as the vision began to disappear into wisps of smoke around me. I was down in the dark hollow of the dead apple tree, blinking the last of the vision out of my eyes. I felt the earth beneath me again, smelled the dank odor of decaying wood, the mustiness of rotten apples, and quickly pushed myself out of that hold, sliding out onto a skin of ice, inadvertently making a blurry snow angel behind me. "This is your story, Aidan Lockwood," the voice said. "Do you understand me?" I sat up to lean back against the trunk of the tree the woman had died in, caught in the web of gnarled branches strung above my very head, and nodded. "If I understand you right," I answered her a second later, "then your name is Ava Jablonski, and your son cursed my family." Chapter 11. The Logic of Ghosts. "What did she say then?" Jared asked later, after I'd gotten up from the ground in a hurry, after I'd refused to stay and listen to the woman in the tree any longer. She had said she had one more thing to show me, but I'd shaken my head, said no, said I'm sorry, said it was all too much, and had run across the railroad tie bridge, returned to the house, passed by my mom at the dining room table, whispering my father's name like a mantra, gone past the open door to Toby's room, where he sat in a chair with his bad ankle in a brace, staring out his window as if he might somehow see my dad appear at the edge of the woods to reveal that everything that had recently happened to us simply wasn't true. After all that, I'd called Jared to ask if I could come over. Half an hour later, I was stretched out across the cushions of his couch with my head cradled in his lap. Staring up at his face was way better than staring up at the ever-widening crack in my bedroom ceiling.
She said that she didn't make the curse, I told him, and described how the woman had shown me the dream my great-grandfather had had on the night she died in his orchard. How she'd shown me the moment her son, Dobry, had made the curse. How she'd reached out from the branches that held her dead body and plucked his words from the air, tucking each one into the folds of her ragged dress for safekeeping.
So, said Jared, she just, what, enforces it? How long has it been?
From what I can guess, I said, about 80 or 90 years, give or take.
That's one hell of a grudge, said Jared.
I think it's what killed my dad, I said.
And I think it's also probably what killed my brother Seth.
I turned away from Jared to stare across the room at the television screen. In the blank gray eye of his mom's ancient TV, this hulking thing that sat on the floor surrounded by a huge cabinet, I saw myself reflected. My head in Jared's lap, his broad chest above me, his fingers playing with my hair, his other hand stroking my arm. In that antique TV, it all looked like a romantic scene from some old black-and-white movie, only with two guys on the couch instead of a man and a woman. Despite the warmth of the reflected image, though, and despite the warmth of Jared's body, I felt cold enough that goosebumps had risen on my skin as I told him what I'd learned.
"You mean your brother who died of a seizure?" Jared asked.
He'd seen Seth's picture in the living room when he was at my house for the first time, months before, had asked if Seth's picture was a photo of me as a little kid. When I told him the truth, when I told him Seth was a brother who had died before I was born, Jared had blinked and stuffed his hands into his back pockets as he looked at the picture once more, this time considering it more thoughtfully, trying to imagine what it would be like to have a sibling you'd never even met. When he turned back to me a second time, he said only that he thought my mom's features were dominant in my family. And I thought, unfortunately. If it weren't for her, after all, if I were more like my dad, I might not have ever seen a vision or been pulled into the world's shadow. I might never have spoken to a ghost who lived in a tree and kept a curse that would inevitably destroy my family.
My mom used to always say Seth died from a seizure, I told Jared now.
That was her story. After I started to see and hear things back in October, though, her story changed. She said Seth had seen something he shouldn't have.
Like what?
I don't know, I said, shaking my head in Jared's lap. It was the woman in the tree, I thought. She'd spoken to Seth, I figured, just like she'd called out to me over the last few months. It had to be that. Or it had to be something like that. She'd shown Seth the vision she'd shown me. Or she'd shown him something else. A white stag, or a man in a black suit wearing a wide-brimmed black hat and a scraggly red beard, his face craggy and pitted. She showed him something that would kill him, or she'd killed him herself somehow. I was sure she had something to do with it.
So why would the woman tell you that story? Jared asked. Why wouldn't she just let the curse take you, too?
I don't know, I said. I felt like she would have if she could have. But something was stopping her. There's something she can't do to me. I could feel that. I just don't know what's stopping her or why.
Listen to us, said Jared, trying to figure out the logic of ghosts, when clearly they have to be pretty irrational to stick around here for so long holding grudges. Why try to make sense of them?
I turned to face him again, relieved to see a corner of his mouth rise into a smile. He ran his fingers through my hair in one long stroke a second later, then leaned down to kiss me. His hair brushed my forehead, and his lips were strong. They tasted of cinnamon and were sweet like sugar. I could have kissed him like that forever, just to feel safe, just to close my eyes and see nothing else in this world. Just to feel nothing else in this world but my skin against his breath on my collarbone, my fingers tracing the cage of his ribs as he enveloped me. Nothing felt more right than that. Nothing felt more right than the two of us. I just didn't know how to make us work beyond the shelter of this trailer on the far edge of town. I didn't know how to make us work beyond the secrecy of my bedroom. And I worried that what we had together, this fire between us, could be put out by others if we were visible. If we let anyone see us. When Jared pulled away, I said, "You have to be pretty irrational, too, to stick around here for so long, you know." "Around Temperance?" he said, grinning, waiting for me to turn what I was saying into a joke of some kind. "No," I said. "Around me." And I wasn't joking. I couldn't muster an ironic tone because I believed what I was saying. That I wasn't worth it. That I had too many problems. Even if he was gay and his dating pool limited by being in Temperance, he could have found someone else. Someone whose family wasn't so messed up. Jared's smile disappeared then, but his hand found mine and squeezed, hard, tight, like he would never let me go. "Being in love isn't irrational," he said. "It only looks that way to people who have never felt it." "Is that what we are?" I asked. "In love?" For a moment after I put the question out there, it filled the room like a fog. I tried to see the two of us the way anyone else might if they were to open the door of the trailer right then. I tried to see myself lying beneath Jared, my hands drifting under his shirt to slide across the warm skin of his back. Then I wasn't trying to see, wasn't imagining anything at all, as my hands did find their way under his shirt and began to travel up the warm skin of his back. Then he was leaning down, kissing me harder than before, and I put my arms around him, kissing him harder too, like we were in this ridiculous kissing contest or something. Who could obliterate the other one with his lips? Who could show the other one he wanted him more? Then he was fumbling with the button of my jeans until suddenly he released it, and then both of our mouths parted, as if we were somehow both surprised at this conclusion. Then we closed our mouths again, put them back against one another. In love. It felt like a real possibility. It felt like it was more than a possibility, actually. Like maybe it was our destiny. If you believed in destiny. The way Jared sometimes talked, and the way I was turning down paths I never knew existed, I was starting to believe. I thought back to the vision I'd shared with him when we were in middle school. The one I'd shown him in Mill Creek. The one he would eventually show me. What had I really shown him that day? "A future where we were still friends," he'd said, when I'd asked him that question a few months earlier. Then he looked out the window of the Blue Bomb as we drove home, as if he was embarrassed by something he couldn't admit. That wasn't the truth, of course, and I could see it now. He'd played down that vision. I'd shown him something more than our friendship lasting into the future. I'd shown him something more like this, something more like now, where the two of us were alone in this ramshackle trailer on the outskirts of town, him squeezing my hand as he pulled away from a kiss to finally answer my question. "Is that what we are? In love?" "Yes," he said, low down in his throat, like he didn't want any argument about it. And then the fog of my question began to evaporate, the air to clear between us. "That's what we are." Jared began to slip his hand around my waist, to pull at my jeans, to peel me open. I didn't know what to do, other than what we were already doing, and stopped him to say as much. "Don't worry," he said, brushing his thumb against my cheek. "I can show you." If ghosts weren't entirely logical, neither were human beings. Some human beings, anyway. My mother, for one, had stopped making sense months before, even though I suspected there had to be some kind of method to her madness. But madness might have been the problem in the end. After my father's death, it seemed like my mom stopped making sense even to herself. It was always candles and a fire roaring in the fireplace now,
as if she couldn't see anything outside of the flames she constantly stared into. It was as if the material world had dropped away from her abruptly, and she kept falling now, falling away from a reality she couldn't face. When I came home from Jared's later, my mom wasn't in the living room staring into the fireplace, though. Then she wasn't in the dining room staring into the flickering light of a candle. The house was silent except for the creak of floorboards as I stepped across them. But as I started up the stairs to the second floor, I heard muffled voices, and when I reached the top step, the voices became clearer. Words slipped beneath my brother's closed door and skittered across the hallway like mice. I stepped closer, quiet as I could, until I was at the door with my ear pressed against it. "Try harder," my mom was telling Toby. "You had to have seen something more. Something else. You're able to do that, you know. If you try hard enough, you can see things other people can't. You're a lucky one, Toby, like your brother and me. You just have to give yourself permission."
"I don't know what you're talking about, Mom," Toby said, and I heard a note of totally freaked out ringing through his voice. "I've told you everything," he continued. "I was up on the ridge in my stand. Dad was down in his. I could see him from above. Right before he fell, he raised his muzzle loader up to his shoulder like he was going to shoot at something. But there were no deer around, as far as I could see. There wasn't anything. It was just snow and the wind blowing more snow. We hadn't seen anything all day but some squirrels digging around in the drifts. Then Dad shot, and then the next thing I knew, he was clutching his chest like all the air had gone out of him. Then he started to lean forward, like something was pulling him over, like he was struggling to stand. Then he fell from the tree, and I started to climb down mine to go to him. I'm telling you, that's all I saw. That's everything."
"Well," my mother said, "I suppose this is partially my fault."
"How?" Toby asked. "What are you talking about?"
She was silent at first. Then quietly she said, "I should never have blinded all of you. I should never have told that story."
"Please, Mom,"
Toby said in the weak voice that only came out of him in his most anxious moments, which were rare, almost non-existent, or at least had been up until the past few weeks.
"I don't know what you're talking about. You're scaring me."
I thought about opening the door and interrupting. I thought about bursting in and demanding she tell us what she was going on about with this story she kept mentioning, like she'd done the night Jared came over. But right as I grabbed the knob, I heard her stand and scrape Toby's desk chair back into place before saying,
"You don't have to be afraid, Toby. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to keep us all safe."
The floorboards creaked as she came toward the door, and I turned to go back downstairs. I only made it to the midway landing before the door opened, though, and I turned around fast, put my hand on the newel post, and pretended I was just then coming up. "Hey," I said as my mom closed Toby's door behind her. She didn't say anything at first, just stared down at me as I came the rest of the way up. When I reached the top, she said, "You have something in your eyes," and reached out as if she were going to pluck a speck of dust away from my eyelashes. I flinched and backed up to the edge of the staircase as if she were about to hit me, and she dropped her hand.
"Why are you looking at me like that?" she asked. "I wasn't going to hurt you."
"My eyes are fine," I said. "I'm just tired."
"You shouldn't be going out all the time," she said.
"Your father would be upset if he knew how often you're not at home now. He'd be upset if he knew how much time you spend with Jared." I flinched again, this time at what she was implying. She knew Jared and I were doing more than playing video games and studying for tests. She knew everything, unfortunately. And she knew that my dad would have been ashamed of me if he'd known. Guilt was her weapon of choice tonight. But I refused to let her work that kind of magic on me. "I still get my homework and chores done," I said in my defense. I wasn't going to let her use my dead father to guilt me from beyond the veil. No way she should get to say what he'd think or feel about anything, I figured. Especially since she hadn't been able to find his spirit over the past few weeks of her constant scrying. She shook her head and said, "That's not the point." "What is the point?" I demanded. "The point," my mother said, then stopped mid-sentence to stare at me, her eyes frozen somewhere between anger and confusion. "The point," she repeated, still unable to complete her answer. She turned quickly then and retreated to her room, clicking the door shut behind her, as if she'd realized she would have only shamed herself if she'd finished that sentence. "Yeah," I whispered, alone in the hallway again. "I kind of figured." At school, since my dad died, people had started to treat me a little differently. They'd started to see me, to nod in the hallways, to say hello, to ask how I was doing. After all the years I'd spent being invisible, I didn't know what to make of the attention. Why had they all changed so suddenly? Was it because my dad had died in a hunting accident? In a town like Temperance, where more than half of the junior and senior classes were absent on the first day of deer season, there would be sympathy for something like that. People would think, that could have been me or my dad. They would see me now because when they looked at me, they'd see themselves. Or was it because I was always hanging out with Jared Doyle? Jared had joined the baseball team and was off the charts better than the other players. And because of that, he'd started to scale the ladder of popularity without much effort. Had I been lifted up into the range of everyone else's vision because he'd taken an interest in me? Maybe it was both of those things. Sympathy for a guy whose father died while hunting. Respect for a guy who a popular, seemingly normal person like Jared had taken under his wing. Whatever the reason, it didn't matter. I nodded back, returned their hellos, smiled at their smiles, said I was fine, thank you. I did and said normal things. But it was too late to truly become friends with people I'd hardly spent any time with in the last few years. I mean real time. Not just forced to occupy the same space for several hours at school 5 days a week. "You were liked," Jared had said when I'd asked if I used to have friends, back before my mom did something to mess up my head. Any one of these people might have once been a friend, and I just couldn't remember. And neither, it seemed, could they, thanks to my mother. On top of that, each time I tried to search inside myself for the memories she'd hidden from me, a flash of white pain would burn through my brain like a bolt of lightning. Like the bolt of lightning that burned through the trunk of the living death tree, hollowing it out from top to bottom. I didn't let this depress me. There were only a few months of classes left, and I didn't want to play the role of the nobody who suddenly becomes everyone's friend right before graduation. Those kinds of endings to books and movies always seemed dishonest, as if the point of life was to be liked and accepted. I didn't need to be liked or accepted. I needed to know and to accept myself. And when I dug down through the muck of my mixed-up memories and feelings, the only person I could say I wanted to be around right then was Jared. Everyone else? They were paper people. They were the background to my life. Jared was the foreground. At lunch, I told Jared what I'd overheard in my brother's room when I got home the night before.